Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today we bring you the third episode in a three-part series from the 2026 Camden Conference. The Camden Conference is an annual three-day event that brings together speakers from around the world to discuss an aspect of contemporary foreign affairs. This year's theme was Today's Middle East: Power, Politics, and Players. It was held in mid-February, before the beginning of the war with Iran. This week we're presenting talks from six of this year's speakers. You can find out more about the Camden Conference, as well as videos from every speaker and Q&A session at camdenconference.org. On today's episode, we hear from former UN Special Advisor Stephanie Williams about the struggles of stateless peoples in the Middle East and Northern Africa, and from former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs Jeffrey Feltman about the shifting balance of power between the Middle East, the United States, and other global superpowers. These talks were recorded in front of a live audience on February 22nd. We begin with an introduction from moderator Meghna Chakrabarty, host and editor of NPR and WBUR's On Point.
Okay, so today we are going to begin with Stephanie Williams. She's a senior non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Prior to that, she led the UN's mediation that resulted in a nationwide Libyan ceasefire agreement signed on October 23rd, 2020, and a political agreement reached on February 5th, 2021, which produced Libya's first unity government in 7 years. Her experience also includes being special advisor to the Secretary General on Libya, head of the UN support mission in Libya. She's also served in Iraq and Jordan, Bahrain, UAE, Kuwait, and Pakistan, to say the least. She's author of Libya Since Gaddafi, Chaos and the Search for Peace. Stephanie Williams, welcome.
Good morning. Or as we say in Arabic, sabah al khair. Good to see everyone here. I want to first thank Meghna and the organizers of this wonderful conference that has brought me to this gorgeous neck of the woods. This morning, I'm going to speak to you about three things. I'm going to start with a topic that is regional, and I've taken some liberties. The conference is really focused on the Middle East, which is the Sharq al-Awsat, the East. Sometimes we include Egypt in that. But I'm going to extend to North Africa, where I also spent some years of my career. And the first topic I'm going to talk about are the stateless peoples of the region. And I will start in the Northeast with the Kurds in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. I will move south to Kuwait, which actually has a stateless population. I'll touch briefly. I'll then go west and talk about Palestinians, who we heard a lot about yesterday. And then I'm going to move far west into North Africa to talk about a couple of marginalized and stateless populations, particularly on the southern borders of Libya and Algeria, but then also a group called the Amazigh, or the Berber people, who span really from Libya through Algeria to Morocco. I know I'm leaving out other groups, but I'm really focusing on peoples who I came into contact in my career in the Foreign Service, where I spent 24 years, and then the 4 years that I spent in Libya with the United Nations. So the second issue I will talk about are peoples in the region who live in failed states. So these are peoples without a state. They're not stateless peoples, but they do live in states that don't function. We can talk about that. And then lastly, I'm going to talk about kind of what does this all mean for us as Americans, for American foreign policy, in light of some of, I think, the devastating decisions that the Trump administration has taken with regard to, you know, international assistance. Of course, I'll cycle back now and start with the stateless peoples. You know, Hannah Arendt, I think, really defined what statelessness means. She was a stateless person herself. She was a refugee. And in some cases, These stateless populations are victims of geography. They literally were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so you have populations who just were literally on the wrong side of the border, or they're divided by geography or large swaths of desert when it comes to North Africa. It was Immanuel Kant, after all, who said that geography lies at the basis of history. So a lot of these peoples also were nomadic in the sense that they were just pulling up stakes and moving here and there. And, you know, back before the borders meant anything, that was easy to do. And then the borders were drawn and they were separated from their fellow tribesmen and families, and their traditional mobility was suddenly curtailed. So they became minorities in the successor states. And those boundaries negated what could possibly have been a more natural process for a similar group of people to cohere and identify as a distinct national entity. And then on the part of the new nations, they soon became powerful enough to prevent that integration, that coalescence of a national project for the subjugated minority group. I'm going to begin our exploration by looking at the Kurds. I'm sure many of you, maybe your first knowledge was the terrible massacre in Halabja, 1988. Others may have come to know the Kurds through Operation Provide Comfort, which the US, after the first Gulf War, led this coalition to provide protection, humanitarian assistance in a no-fly zone for the northern part of Iraq. And that's because Saddam Hussein was vengeful following that war. And he turned not only on the Kurds, but as we know, he turned on the Shia in the southern part of Iraq. So just to give you a sense of the scale of the Kurdish population, globally, it's estimated to be between 30 and 45 million people. So if you compare it to a nation, it'd be the size of Poland or Uzbekistan. So the majority of the Kurds today live between Turkey, where they form about 25% of the population, Iraq, 20%, Iran, 10%, and Syria, 9%. So the dispersal has complicated their national project. I know it's definitely a cliche, but I think it can still be said that the Kurds have no friends but the mountains. For example, in Turkey, which now goes by the name Turkey, but I will use the terminology Turkey, they've waged a long-running struggle, sometimes violently, with the government in Ankara over political recognition, cultural rights, and local governance. In Iraq, as I've noted, they were brutally targeted by Saddam. For a long while, though, because of Operation Provide Comfort, which had the no-fly zone, and then after 2003, when Iraq descended into violence and civil war, the Kurds in northern Iraq enjoyed a great deal of autonomy from the government in Baghdad. And we saw that really even up until the present time. In 2017, I was in Baghdad. I was the second in command at the US Embassy. This was all during the lead up to the liberation of Mosul from Daesh. After that, in the fall of 2017, the Iraqi Kurds decided to have a referendum, supposed to be a non-binding referendum, to ask the Kurdish population in Iraq if they favored independence, separation from Baghdad, from the country of Iraq. And it was like 92%. Not a surprise. Kurds were not really fond of the authorities in Baghdad. But after the liberation of Mosul, of course, Baghdad felt stronger, right? And they had neighbors, the Iranians and the Turks, who were not interested in a Kurdish independence status anywhere in northern, and especially in northern Iraq. So they were hit by economic sanctions, the Kurds were. The government in Baghdad moved militarily into the Kurdish region. taking a lot of land. And eventually, the Kurdish authorities dropped their independence bid. In Iran, we heard a lot about Iran yesterday. The Kurds form a minority, and as we heard, they have been among the pillars of the opposition to the theocratic regime, and with terrible consequences for the Iranian Kurds. Now, the story of the Kurds in Syria, probably most of you learned about this group in northern Syria, particularly in northeastern Syria, in 2014, when the Daesh started moving in their waves across the Syria and into Iraq. And I was in Jordan at the time. And I was there when we made the decision. The U.S. Special Forces advocated for a partnership with the Kurds in Syria. And they did amazing work with our forces. And we also saw in that pocket in Syria, you know, a great deal of autonomy for the Kurds, because the central government was in chaos, the country Syria was plunged into civil war, and it was really an astonishing experiment in self-rule for the Kurds in Syria, particularly as regards the empowerment of women. That all came to an end, pretty much, in recent days, in recent weeks, when the new Syrian government, with the assistance of the Turkish government, and I would say a green light from Washington, defeated the Syrian Democratic Forces and brought those areas under the aegis of the central government. So, you know, a very mixed bag for the Kurdish people. Periods of autonomy, but then the reassertion of central control. So, let's move on to the Badoon. I'm wagering that not a lot of people have heard about this population. Badoon in Arabic means without, and it means without nationality, literally. So estimates vary in terms of the size of this population, but it's probably in the range of 100,000. Most of the Badoon are descendants of nomadic tribes from across the Arabian Peninsula. And when Kuwait gained independence in 1961, they started to register nationals. About a third of the population was unable to register, a lot of it because they were on the move. They were in Saudi Arabia, they were moving to Iraq, but they really identified as Kuwaitis. But up until the 1980s, they basically enjoyed all the rights of Kuwaiti citizens. I remember being a consular officer in Kuwait, and they had laissez-passer, sort of travel documents, and we would just treat them like Kuwaitis, grant them, you know, 10-year visas, because we knew that they were coming back, because they had all the services. But that came to an end. And the Kuwaiti government changed the status of the Badoon to illegal residents. And so now they are without services, they live on the margins, and there are consequences in terms of radicalization. You just have to point to an individual like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the mastermind of 9/11, who was originally, the family was from Balochistan, but they had sort of settled in this, you know, Badoon population in Kuwait, and they were also on the margins, and I think you could say that perhaps contributed to his radicalization. So, that's the Badoon. And now we'll move briefly to the Palestinians. We spent a lot of time on the Palestinians yesterday, but the global population is about 15 million. 5.9 are registered as refugees, including the descendants of those displaced in 48 and 67. And those refugees live primarily in the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, where I served, Lebanon and Syria. Jordan alone has more than 2 million registered Palestinian refugees, while Lebanon and Syria respectively have about 420,000. I would recommend, it's up in the bookstore, there's a great book that was recently authored by Rob Malley and Hussein Agha. It's called Tomorrow is Yesterday, and it really walks you through the peace process, and I think is one of the most kind of candid analyses and from people who were deeply immersed in the process. Okay. Let's move quickly. Okay, now we're in North Africa. These are the Tebu. The Tebu are a Saharan non-Arab population that they're on the southern borders of Libya with Chad and Niger. They were persecuted in Libya during the Gaddafi regime, particularly when he had his Arabization move or policy. But they identified with the revolutionaries in 2011, so their lot has improved a little bit. But there's a lot of tension between the Tebu and the Arab tribes who live in southern Libya. The Tuareg are a group, also a Saharan group, who border southern Libya, Algeria, Burkina Faso, all across what we would now call the Sahel and the coup belt. They were more identified with the Gaddafi regime, so they have really suffered since 2011, and a lot of them have been stripped of their rights and their nationality. They have a very strange administrative status in Libya, and where they reside is actually the home to ISIS, Al-Qaeda, human trafficking, arms trafficking, all kinds of trafficking. So they live in a great deal of insecurity. The last population I'll talk about are the Amazigh, or the Berber population. And they're related to the Tuareg. But they, across North Africa, have historically faced discrimination, including the banning of their language. In Libya, Gaddafi absolutely sought to crush the Amazigh identity. And now you can say the Amazigh are really the original inhabitants of this area. He told them, you can call yourselves whatever you want inside your homes, Berbers, children of Satan, whatever, but you are only Libyans when you leave your home. They form about 16% of the population in Libya. Their lot has also improved since the revolution. They are now allowed to teach their language in schools and to fly their flag, and that's the Amazigh flag, and to celebrate their new year. But because Libya still lacks a constitution 15 years after the revolution, they have yet to see their rights formally enshrined. They have a much better situation in Morocco, by the way, where the constitution that was written in 2011 does enshrine rights for the Berber people. So now let me move quickly to the crisis of statelessness. And this is the failed states. And I lived and worked in two failed states, Iraq and Libya. And I think those who, and for various reasons, the decision to engage militarily to topple these regimes failed to appreciate the degree to which in which the regime, the organs of the regimes, penetrated the state institutions. So once you rip out the regime, what do you have left? Nothing. I mean, when I went to Iraq in 2016, the health ministry was not delivering health services. They had torture chambers in the basement of the health ministry where they were torturing Iraqi civilians. And these were the Shia militias that, really came to prominence. So in both countries, you also saw these sort of punitive campaigns against supporters of the regime, de-Ba'athification in Iraq, obviously the abolition of the military. In Libya, there was a very punitive political isolation law, which just instantly turned supporters, even very low-level supporters of the regime, into your enemies. And then, again, the armed militias that came to the fore, particularly in Libya. And we saw also the emergence of Daesh in both countries that necessitated the intervention of the United States militarily to rid these populations of ISIS. So there we are in Libya. We had state collapse, uncontrolled borders, violence, poverty, climate change. These all sort of combine, again, to render the stateless peoples that we talked about even more vulnerable in these environments. In Jordan, and here I'll talk about another sort of group of stateless, marginalized people, which of course are the millions of refugees that these conflicts have produced. I was in Jordan when the refugees from Syria started pouring across the border, 1.3 million at the height. And we still have, Jordan still hosts probably up to, I don't know what the numbers are, but possibly up to 1 million Syrians are still in Jordan because they don't have homes to go back to. It was a real sort of Herculean effort to work with. We worked very closely with the United Nations, both in Jordan and in Iraq, and frankly in Libya as well. When I was in the UN, I worked closely with the US government to provide humanitarian assistance. But in Libya, the uncontrolled borders just led to a huge pouring of people across the southern borders up to the Mediterranean. That's Jordan, that's Zaatari. And then this is really the scene almost every day off the coast of Libya, with these people being trafficked by these gangs, these mafiosos who put them in these boats. And then, you know, something like, I think the numbers now are, since 2014, 28,000 migrants have drowned in the Mediterranean. It's shocking numbers, right? And now I think as a result of the war in Sudan, we're going to see more people, but they're going to move up the eastern side of Libya and onto boats, probably heading, a lot of them are going to Greece now. So I'm going to quickly just wrap it up by saying, look, no surprise, the gutting of our soft power by the Trump administration and slashing of the funds for the international organizations, it's had a direct impact on these populations. And I think, you know, it's just going to exacerbate what is already a horrible situation. In the first year since USAID was shuttered, more than 600,000 people have died after being cut off from assistance. And the projections are that if this continues, it could surge to 14 million by 2030. And a lot of that's going to come from Africa, which is has the fastest growing population in the world. And, you know, starvation, malnutrition, climate change is going to, a lot of people are going to be on the move because they literally can't live in their countries. So, you know, General Mattis used to say when he was the head of CENTCOM and he testified before Congress in 2013, he said, if you don't fund the State Department fully, then I need to buy more ammunition. So again, that, you know, minor, very small investment in soft power, I think will do us a great deal of good as we look down the road to these crises which are still continuing. And I will, I'll leave it there.
Okay, so I wanted to hear a little bit more, Stephanie, about stateless people within the failed states that you were talking about, because you just briefly began discussing them. Like, tell us more about what their plight is, and for as long as the state remains failed, they are doubly trapped.
Right. So it's a double-edged sword, yeah. Because in some cases, when the central government just implodes, and you know, you could see that in Libya and in Iraq, there's maybe some room for maneuver for these populations. But it's, you know, there's no security, that's for sure. And particularly in Libya, where, you know, the south of Libya, which is where all of the sort of stateless, marginalized populations live, and also in the, you know, the western mountains where the Amazigh Berber live, there is no security. And so literally you have gangs, you know, militias, armed groups, mafias, traffickers, Daesh, Al-Qaeda. So yes, I mean, the central government's not breathing down their necks, but there's just a lot of generalized insecurity and chaos. And then the whole complication of, you know, the constitutional process you know, in a place like Libya, which really needs to be completed as part of a broader political negotiation, so that these groups, you know, have their rights enshrined, that they can take, for some of them, like the Amazigh and to an extent the Tebu, the Tuareg is a different story because of their association with Gaddafi, but that, you know, these groups can sort of, you know, finalize, cash in on the rights that they have acquired.
Okay, so let's stay with Libya a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I mean, as you said, it's still obviously highly unstable, to put it lightly. What ideally would be the next sort of critical steps to begin stabilization there?
So the ceasefire that I negotiated in 2020 is holding, knock on everything. There has not been nationwide. So that ceasefire was a nationwide agreement where, you know, Libya has had, well, if you count the revolution, it's had three civil wars, but it's had two civil wars since the revolution. So that has held, but there is localized violence, particularly in Tripoli. In the east of Libya, there's like a very strong man, kind of, you know, a general who brutally controls the eastern part of the eastern and a good deal of the south. But in the west, it's just much more chaotic. There are still, you know, armed groups. There's no monopoly on the use of force. This was another, I think, kind of, we didn't really think through the overthrow of Gaddafi because he opened his arsenal. And Libyans like guns generally. I think there's, you know, they have something in common with the United States. And they don't like to give up their weapons. And, you know, if you've got a gun, no one's going to stop you from using it. You're going to use it. And so getting control of this, because there was really no military under Gaddafi. He had, you know, armed groups associated with his children. And so getting that process going, it has not happened yet. So I think that really needs to happen. And then politics will follow security.
Okay. This conference it's my first time here, as you all know, and it's so remarkable insofar as our speakers have literally been in the room. They were critical players in the room and in so many important moments in recent history. So do you mind if I ask, like, put us in the room next to you when you were negotiating that ceasefire? Because it's not often I get to sit next to someone and say, when I was negotiating a ceasefire. What was it like? Were there any moments, or pick a moment where you felt like everything was gonna fall apart? Who did you sit across the table from? What were their personalities like?
So we actually started negotiating with what was called the Joint Military Commission, composed of military officers, and that's a very loose term, from both sides of the conflict, when the war was hot. And they wouldn't, you know, it was kind of like the Syrians. They wouldn't meet in the same room. They wouldn't stay in the same hotel. They would have, even though they knew each other very, very well. It was very tense, but we just gradually built on that. And then when there was a cessation of hostilities, which was also a result of massive external intervention in Libya, which, if anyone knew, I write about it in my book, but it's that also helped actually to bring the hostilities to an end, because the Turks came in really big for the UN government against the Emiratis, the Russians, the Trump administration, first Trump administration. It was a really bizarre cast of characters on either side. But anyways, once the guns were silent, and we wanted to keep them silent through a formal arrangement, that's when we picked up the ball. And it was during COVID, so that actually helped. Because they started talking over Zoom or Microsoft Teams, and that they warmed up. And then we said, okay, let's have a kind of test meeting, which took place in Egypt. And then they said, okay, we're ready.
Who were the they?
The Libyans were ready. The members, the military officers were ready to actually sit down. And actually, one of the things I did was for a day, we did this in Geneva, I left them to themselves in the room because they know each other. I mean, Libya is literally a 6 degrees of separation country. So they needed to work, through stuff and not like perform for the mediator. So they did that and they came out and they said, you know what, we're ready. And that, literally, that was it. And I mean, you know, we shaped it, but it was there. It's a sovereign decision. It's their decision. And you have to respect that and go at their speed, their tempo, not your tempo.
All right. Jeffrey Feltman is the John C. Whitehead Visiting Fellow in International Diplomacy in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He's also a senior fellow at the United Nations Foundation. Now, maybe more appropriately, I should be saying Ambassador Feltman was the first U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa from April 2021 to January 2022. From 2012 to 2018, he was also the UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And prior to that, he was a Foreign Service Officer. He was the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. He has served in numerous places across the region: Erbil, Baghdad, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Tunis, Amman, Budapest, and Port-au-Prince. So even outside the Middle East. Welcome, Ambassador.
Thank you very much. It's a real privilege to be here. And like the other speakers, I just want to thank the Camden Conference for including me in this really impressive event. It's great to see all the participants, the students, and it's an honor to be here with my fellow speakers as well. Like some of the other speakers, my flight got canceled, of course, given the incoming storm. And I was thinking about, the last time I can remember a weather-related flight cancellation I was on, I was in Pyongyang in December 2017. And my flight out of Pyongyang after a week was canceled. And I decided I'd rather be stranded in Maine. Now, over the last 2 days, you know, you've heard how unsettled this moment is for the Middle East. You know, Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, rising Israeli-Turkish tensions, the rivalry between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. Pivotal upcoming Israeli elections. The region we've been discussing is in flux. And at the same time, this is happening while the wider international system stumbles. You know, as Ian Bremmer put it, you know, the United States is itself unwinding its own global order. Prime Minister Mark Carney from Canada called this at Davos a rupture. And so against that backdrop today, I want to talk on two different themes. First, another look after all the brilliant presentations we've heard over the past couple days at that intersection between U.S. foreign policy and the interests of the Middle Eastern states we've been discussing. And second, let's open the aperture a bit, go beyond the region a bit, and consider the global order as the Trump administration takes basically a wrecking ball to the institutions, the alliances that the United States, more than any other country, has built and sustained for decades. And I speak as someone who's served both as a U.S. official focused on the Middle East and a U.N. official with global responsibilities. So my first theme, that intersection of U.S. and Middle Eastern countries' interests, let me start with an anecdote. When the Biden administration came into office, there were rumors that I was going to be asked to be the U.S. Special Envoy for Syria. Well, back in January 2021, I had no good ideas for Syria. So I sort of very carefully practiced a script to politely say no. But then when the call came, it was a big surprise to be the first U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa. I had no script prepared for that. And there are lots of Americans, you know, why me? There are lots of Americans who have lived and worked, spent their professional careers in and around the Horn of Africa. And that wasn't me. At the UN, I traveled a lot to the Horn of Africa, but I'm not a Horn of Africa expert, and I said so on the phone call. The response was, hey, Jeff, think about the geopolitical map, not just the geographic map. You know the Arabs, the Turks, the Israelis, and those are the people who are going to have decisive influence on that region. And that was prescient. This was said before Sudan's civil war erupted and before the hardening of two loose competing alignments. In these two alignments, it's Israel and the UAE on the one side, it's Turkey and Saudi Arabia, often joined by Egypt and Qatar on the other side. These two alliances are now the central drivers of the trajectory of the Middle East, of Sudan, and of the Horn of Africa. The Trump administration is close to all of them. All these countries welcomed the election of Trump, but the administration's ability to transcend the gap between these two loose coalitions remains unproven. Now, we saw a precursor of this during the boycott of Qatar during Trump's first term. But this divide today is deeper, broader, and harder to manage. Take Syria. Syria is in the midst of a historic but fragile transition. The Trump administration is all in behind interim President Ahmed Shara. Riyadh, Doha, Ankara are more or less in the same spot. Israel and the UAE are not. They prefer centrifugal forces inside Syria that would undercut this US goal of a consolidated Syria under Ahmed al-Shara's interim rule. Both Israel and the UAE see the Islamist background of Ahmed Shara as threatening. Both of them would resist seeing Turkey increase its influence in Syria. I don't see either Israel or the UAE adjusting its policies to align with the Trump focus on backing a centralized Syria right now. But the rivalry of these two camps I'm describing, and they're not formal alliances, they're basically sort of informal alignments, the rivalry extends beyond the Middle East to Sudan and the Horn of Africa. So again, widening our aperture a bit. The money, weapons, and political cover of these countries have transformed local conflicts into international proxy battles with incredibly catastrophic humanitarian consequences. And Sudan is now a primary battlefield in this contest. Sudan, host of the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe right now. Now, the Trump administration pitched a clever idea to try to stop Sudan's civil war. Build a quad of outside powers, Washington, Riyadh, Abu Dhabi, and Cairo. The idea was simple. The UAE supports one side of the Sudan civil war. Egypt and Saudi Arabia support the other side of the Sudan civil war. If you get consensus among these outsiders, they can use their collective leverage to force their Sudanese clients into a ceasefire. It's a good theory on paper. In practice, it has at least so far failed. The Quad issued a ceasefire call in September. The Sudanese armed forces, backed by Egypt and the Saudi Arabia, flatly rejected it. They're sort of posturing as a government. The rapid support forces, supported by the UAE, pretended to accept the ceasefire call, and then in late October carried out the single worst atrocity of the war, the massacres in El-Fasher, in Darfur. And the fighting continues, engulfing every neighboring state. So why did this Quad approach that makes sense on paper collapse? Because our Quad partners understand clearly that Washington has a long list of other issues on which they want their cooperation. This gives our Quad partners the confidence to pick and choose. When are they going to cooperate with the Trump administration, and when can they ignore the Trump administration at relatively low cost? You know, they hear President Trump's repeated denigration of African countries. They note how rarely he mentions Sudan. And they draw the obvious conclusion that ending Sudan's civil war is not really a top priority in the Oval Office, despite the humanitarian consequences. Meanwhile, Sudan's assets, its 530-mile Red Sea coast, its fertile agricultural land, Nile River waters, its gold reserves, are simply too important for one of these sides to allow the other side to win. And so the Quad partners calculate that they can participate in the Quad meetings and discussions with Washington, they can strike a constructive tone, and they can continue to arm the belligerents with very little cost to their relationship with the United States. Now, I experienced this myself firsthand as the U.S. envoy for the Horn of Africa under the Biden administration. The White House regularly asked me to boil down our message on Ethiopia's Tigray War, which was then raging. Ethiopia's Tigray War, by the way, there were estimated 600,000 people killed in that Tigray War from 2020 to 2022. That war was also intensified by external interference of the same type I'm describing in Sudan. So I was supposed to boil down what I was talking about to ministers and other officials to like a single talking point or two for President Biden to talk to the regional leaders to reinforce my message at the very, very top level. And then the phone calls would happen, the visits would happen, and invariably, I would get a call back from the White House and say, you know, Jeff, thanks for the point, but you know, the agenda was so long, the president never got to Ethiopia. And even if Massad Boulos, who's President Trump's senior Africa advisor, is pushing hard on Sudan, and I actually think he is, the Quad leaders are not naive. If the president consistently fails to mention Sudan, they will conclude that Sudan is not a priority for him, but it is for them, and they will act accordingly. And we see the same dangerous competition between these two loose coalitions around the Bab al-Mandab. The Bab al-Mandab is where the Red Sea meets the Gulf of Aden and then onto the Indian Ocean. On December 26, Israel recognized Somaliland. Somaliland is the breakaway part of Somalia. It's on the inside cover of your book on the map where it says Somalia. That's the part of Somalia that's Somaliland. So Israel recognizes Somaliland on December 26th, and the UAE already has assets, military assets in Somaliland, the breakaway region. Saudi diplomacy kicked into high gear. Encouraging others not to follow suit with recognition of Somaliland. Egypt, Turkey, and Qatar rushed to reaffirm Somalia's territorial integrity. And about the same time, the UAE's backed Southern Transitional Council in Yemen. Yemeni forces backed by the UAE moved against Saudi-backed forces in Yemen, breaking what had been sort of an understanding about UAE controls in Yemen and Saudi control in Yemen. And so from Riyadh's perspective, Riyadh's suddenly looking at this Somaliland, Yemen, and saying, on both sides of the Red Sea, Bab al-Mandab, that gateway, Saudi access is being bracketed by Emirati and Israeli influence. So Riyadh responded on December 30th by attacking Emirati shipments to the Emirati allies in Yemen. Abu Dhabi reportedly pulled its assets out of Yemen. But the story doesn't end there. Remember Somaliland, I've mentioned. Its so-called president met Eric Trump in Davos. And the pictures from that meeting told the region, rightly or wrongly, that the United States is being directly engaged in the question of recognition and secession along the Red Sea. Now, I keep mentioning these two camps. Well, there are two dynamics that animate these camps, that energize these two camps. One is the very poisonous relationship between Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and Turkish President Erdogan. It's more than just Turkey and Israel. It's a very personal animosity between these two leaders. And the other is the now very public rivalry between Abu Dhabi and Riyadh. Now, some will argue that Turkish-Saudi camp is essentially statist, backing central authorities, while the Israeli-UAE camp supports secessionist movements to weaken potential rivals. And while there's some truth to that, you know, I question how the Saudi-Turkish support of the Sudanese armed forces in their current form really, really helps support a central state. To me, this is less about statehood theory and more about power. Who will dominate a strategic region at a time when successive American administrations have wanted to reduce our own footprint? And the stakes are not abstract. The risk of an all-out war in the Horn of Africa triggered by these same regional rivalries is real. Even as we meet here today, Ethiopia, the second most populous state on the African continent, and Eritrea, egged on by these same outsiders, are saber-rattling. The risk of war is real. Now, my second theme transcends the larger Middle East, Red Sea Basin area, which is how do we promote peace in the Horn of Africa, in Sudan, in the Middle East, or anywhere, when the system that was established after World War II, built to safeguard peace, is losing both relevance and support. You know, we're living through a crisis of faith in the institutions, the alliances, the treaties, and the understandings that were constructed after World War II. Now, the so-called post-war order was never completely static. It moved from a very early vision of the UN as an instrument of the so-called four policemen in their spheres of influence, through Cold War polarity and decolonization, through into post-Cold War U.S. hegemony, U.S. predominance, and finally into whatever you want to call this more messy arrangements now. But throughout all this period, one constant remained. The United States as the primary architect, manager, benefactor, and yes, beneficiary of the system. So what happens when the system's main sponsor loses interest or even grows actively hostile to its own creation? And we're in a precarious moment. Despite the crisis in multilateralism, globalization itself has not slowed. Think about China's $1.2 trillion trade surplus last year. Challenges from pandemics to climate change ignore borders. Yet the familiar international architecture to manage all this is crumbling before our eyes, and the US maintenance crew has walked off the job. The gap between the expanding reach of globalization and the shrinking ambition for global governance widens by the day. Now, the system we inherited helped prevent another great power war. I'm not minimizing the wars that we've been discussing here, the wars that have taken place elsewhere, but in terms of an actual global conflagration, the post-war system has helped prevent that. But it did so not only through the formal rules that have been established since World War II. The key ingredients for success of the so-called rules-based international order in preventing World War III included self-restraint and deterrence. The great powers, you know, chastened by 80 million people killed in two world wars, and acutely aware of the risks of nuclear annihilation, exercised restraint. At key moments, the United States restrained its incredible power in favor of global cooperation that it did not fully control. And the UN Charter itself rests on an implicit bargain that the great powers, though strong enough to violate the very principles of that charter, would voluntarily, yes, if inconsistently, refrain from doing so. Restraint is in short supply today. I don't think anyone's going to accuse Trump, Putin, or Xi Jinping of being crippled by excessive self-restraint. And the post-Cold War order also depended on deterrence. But how credible are US security guarantees today? If allies like Japan, the Republic of Korea, Germany, Poland, question US reliability, the nuclear nonproliferation regime, already sort of a little bit threadbare, it's going to further unravel. And we could see Egypt, UAE, Turkey, Saudi Arabia following suit. China is in the process of quadrupling its nuclear arsenal. The Russians are testing very dangerous new systems. The last Russian-US arms control arrangement expired earlier this month. President Trump has vowed to restart nuclear testing. We're at a very dangerous moment in terms of the nuclear file. But meantime, we see the contours of a new kind of arms race that could also lead to conflict. The race for critical minerals, for energy security, water, for dominance in artificial intelligence. These too could provoke great power conflict, or perhaps smaller power conflict that sucks in the great powers. We need to explore how to restore deterrence, how to deter the US and China from heading to war, how to deter great powers from seizing territory or assets from weaker states, how to deter minor conflicts were becoming proxy wars that drag in the great powers that lead to another world war. And given the risk of human extermination, the nuclear issue to me seems particularly urgent. China consistently rebuffs efforts to join nuclear talks. Washington and Moscow don't seem particularly interested right now. So could we widen the circle? Could we initiate nuclear talks in some form among all P5, the five permanent members of the Security Council, to make it harder for some of these states to say no? Even during the height of the Cold War, the Security Council was a venue to start some of the disarmament talks of that period. And with artificial intelligence, we face the danger of weapons being employed without meaningful control. And perhaps it's time to take a cue from Eisenhower. Should we create an IAEA for AI, that is an international agency for artificial intelligence to protect the world from the worst risks of AI while more equitably spreading the benefits of AI? And I've got other ideas I'm skipping because I'm coming close to the end of my time here. But in this polarized world, we will not achieve UN consensus for any proposal. We need to aim for the largest possible coalition and hope others will come on board. And I'm all for helping the next UN Secretary General, who will be elected later this year, to revive quiet diplomacy to prevent and resolve conflicts before they metastasize into great power wars. I have no romantic notion about the UN. It's not that the UN is a particularly magical tool, but the UN remains the most powerful symbol of our aspirations for a treaty-based international order and for peaceful global cooperation. And this is not multilateralism's first crisis. We can all come up with a list: Srebrenica, Rwanda, Gaza, Sudan, Sudan, Ukraine. The list of failures is long. But what is new is that the engine behind international cooperation, the United States and its Western partners, has stalled. Yes, the United States has at times acted contrary to the rules that we more than anyone else did to draft. And yes, the United States and its partners have been on the opposite sides before. The Iraq War comes to mind. But until now, we have never seen a sustained effort by the United States to denigrate and distance itself from our transatlantic allies. You know, I, for one, do not think it's very reassuring to think about Greenland and say, well, I guess it could have been worse. You know, peace will not preserve itself. And the post-war order needed reviving and refreshing even before the current crisis. But who's going to step forward and chart a new path in the absence of U.S. leadership? China certainly has weight. But China has shown no interest. Maybe this is good. But China has shown no interest in replacing the United States as the protector of global public goods. So where does that leave us? As the pushback against the seizure of Greenland illustrated, the middle powers do have some leverage. And for them, the middle powers, the rest of the world, I suggest a three-part agenda. First, find ways to build collective deterrence against predation from great powers, i.e. build on the Greenland example. Second, establish new rules and norms of behavior, new frameworks to govern peacefully the race for rare minerals, energy resources, and AI, and invite others on board. Third, come together around ideas to protect the essential operating systems for an interconnected world, the interconnected world in which we live, in areas like protection of global health, the global financial system, and freedom of navigation. These are areas that the Trump administration has abandoned. And perhaps one day, the United States will again view alliances as assets, not as burdens. But for now, we need to establish the broadest coalition of leaders and countries who insist on refreshing the very idea that gave us eight decades without world war, that our security is bound up with the security of others, and that restraint and cooperation are not signs of weakness, but the highest expressions of confidence and strength. Thank you.
Ambassador, thank you so much.
Just Jeff.
Okay, Jeff. Well, we're going to wrap up with a remote question that comes from Heidi Whitney in North Waterboro. How would you make the case to someone disengaged from global events that these issues matter, especially when U.S. media often gives limited international coverage?
Yeah. This, you, Heidi, you have identified a real problem. Think about how difficult it is for all of us who are trying to stay informed of international events to find out what's actually going on in a source that we can trust. Because if you can Google anything or use any kind of AI to say, okay, what's happening in Sudan now? But how likely is it that you're going to get an objective view of what's happening in Sudan rather than one side trying to persuade you? But I think that the case I would make may not be very compelling I grew up in the rural Midwest. Maybe it would not be compelling when I go back to my hometown. But I think that we benefited tremendously from U.S. leadership. And yes, we underwrote the system. But the benefits to us in terms of our own economic growth, in terms of the talent that came to this country because of the research grants, because of the immigration that attracted talent, that this whole system worked to make our country what it is today. And I really don't want to see us lose all that.
Well, Ambassador, thank you.
Thank you
so very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program was the third in a three-part series from the 2026 Camden Conference, which focused on the current politics of the Middle East. We heard from American diplomats Stephanie Williams and Jeffrey Feltman. Both talks were recorded on February 22nd, before the war with Iran began. You can find this episode on our website at mainepublic.org. Click on shows to find Speaking in Maine and many other on-demand programs. You can also find a link to more info about the Camden Conference and archives of other talks there. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.